It is time for Dig Deep on KEXE KBXE, also available in a podcast and on our website, kexe.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Joining me in the studio on this blustery winter day. Can you believe that wind out there?
Yeah, it's deciding it wants to be winter again, which is cool.
That's the voice of Chuck Marone. He's joining us in the studio. He is our conservative commentator from Strong Towns. That's Aaron Brown. I wanted your voice
because
that's
hi.
The voice. Yes.
I'm Aaron.
And that's the voice of Aaron Brown. And he is our liberal commentator. And you know him from Minnesota Brown. You know him from the Great Northern Radio Show. Thanks for being here today.
Good to be here.
Happy New Year. I feel bad because we try to get something together. And then I do this like mini sabbatical over Christmas break and then had a little trip. Thanks for being patient, everybody.
I think Aaron and I we should have been doing mini sabbaticals, right?
Yeah, that would have been a good idea,
You're
actually.
You're smart. Yeah, we should have had a compromise there. Compromise, that's what this is all about. We compromise on our schedules and how we get together. These are some busy people, and that's kind of our topic for today is with the history of our country, history of government, how compromise works, where it came from, why it's necessary. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but I know you wanted to begin with kind of this evolution of why we set up a legislative branch and judicial branch and executive.
Right. Well, we're right now, as we sit here, in what isn't the longest, but is approaching one of the longest government shutdowns that there has been. Certainly the longest that I can remember. I think the longest in like modern governmental times.
By the time this is on, I'm pretty sure it'll be the longest in history officially.
Yeah, you're assuming it will continue. I think that's a fair assumption.
You know, just an editor's,
you could guess.
Editor's note, you know, by the time you hear this, the shutdown might be over. But it might not be over.
Right.
And either way, it's approaching a record. I think we're days away from the record as we sit here right now.
Well, and we now at the federal level are going to have at least somewhat divided government. We have a Democratic Party in charge of the House of Representatives, and Republicans have a little bit wider majority now in the Senate than they did before the November elections. And then, of course, with Donald Trump in the White House, the Republicans, in theory, have the White House as well, although you know, sometimes they don't count him as a Republican.
It's really hard to say because if you were a true partisan, you could predict some behavior.
Right.
I don't think he's a really unpredictable person. And it's almost like, I don't even know what to compare it to other than our executive branch appears to lack many of the functions it once had.
Sure. The question comes, how does these things get resolved? What ultimately is like a compromise that moves things ahead? If we go back to the early days of the founding of the country, a lot of the compromises that had to be made were a lot more difficult than the ones we have to make today. So I thought it would be interesting. You know, we are a country founded on a revolution, which you can think of as like the anti-compromise. Like what happens when you can't compromise? You take to the street with arms and you start shooting at each other and blood comes out and it's a bad thing. That's like that's the opposite of compromise. But as soon as we resolved that, we entered into this process of creating first an Articles of Confederation, which was unsuccessful for a variety of reasons. And then the US Constitution, which itself is a massive set of compromises, things that we struggle with today.
Right. And you could look at the Constitution, and one of the big issues then and through the history of the Republic was over the issue of slavery, for instance. You had some states where slavery was built into the economic well-being of the landed gentry that ran things, and then other states that were more urban, more industrial, more farming-based, more free, what they call free labor kind of states, they either for economic or moral reasons, quite often economic reasons, didn't want slavery in their state. And so, you know, you had a very big disagreement that they ultimately worked around in the Constitutional Convention and when they put our Constitution together. And indeed, we 80 years later have to have it out in the Civil War to partially resolve that dispute. But the lingering effects of that enshrined institutional, most extreme form of institutional racism, you know, we've been trying to put together and fix and figure out ever since. But that wasn't the only.
No.
That wasn't the only thing, but it was one of the big ones. And there wouldn't have been, like, why is there an America? You know, why aren't we many different little countries? Why did this rich continent get to unite, or most of this continent get to unite in what we call the United States? Why isn't there a South, and why isn't there a New England, and all these different things? And the reason is because of those compromises that created a system and then an economic reality that sticking together was better for business.
I think the early compromises regarding slavery are an interesting look at how really difficult issues are worked out at the legislative level. Because it's one of those that, particularly today in 2019, none of us are comfortable with. I mean, none of us sitting around today in 2019 say, you know, that was a just and fair compromise. It's horrific to us. Like, we look at it, we're like, oh, this just makes us sick to our stomach. But understand what was going on at the time. You had Southern states who were very important to the Union, very important to this kind of burgeoning country. This is where you had the basically the production capacity of the nation, agriculturally productive. A lot of exports from this region. So this was where we were going to bring in capital from, you know, the old world in a sense. The northern regions were these kind of early industrial areas. You know, you had banking, you had industry, you had urbanization, but these were fledgling kind of places.
At the founding, the South was more important for economic reasons.
Very much more important. I think of even like something I'm familiar with, the book publishing industry, or even things like making suits. You know, the history of America was...
Our business was fabric, you know?
Yeah, we would ship fabric over, and then in England, they would make suits and send them back. The same with books. You know, we would not... You know, a lot of the stuff would get sent over from Europe, and then we would distribute them here. But the value add was all coming there. And in the North, you know, they wanted to basically build up and grow these industries as a way to, again, get to the point where you could export, get to the point where you didn't have to import as much. This is how you built a robust domestic economy. Well, how do you keep the South and the North together? One of the arguments was that if we base our representation in this new constitution we're creating on population, which is kind of what a democracy is, you know, if we base it on population, well, that means the North is going to have all the power. If we base it on geography, it also does this really weird thing where, like, well, all of a sudden the South has a disproportionate amount of power. Well, how do you compromise, and I'm using air quotes now, how do you compromise and make that work? Well, one of the compromises floated was, well, let's count slaves as human beings, as people, as part of the population. That raises some interesting questions, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it gets into the notion of, well, if you're using slaves as a reason to allocate representation, theoretically...
Maybe they should have representation.
Maybe they're human beings who deserve representation. But ironically, the let's count slaves emerged from the South,
right,
as a means of getting the more power for their franchised citizens, white men at the time, and it was a means of the South to equal the power of the North, which was the fundamental, I think, coming out of the Constitutional Convention. That was the reason we have a constitution and arguably a country at that time.
Right. So you have this really uncomfortable and certainly hypocritical in terms of our founding documents, compromise kind of embedded into this thing as a way to move on to the next step, as a way to like piece things together. The House and the Senate is another one of these compromises. Are we going to be represented based on geography? Are we going to be represented based on population? The answer was yes. We'll split it up and we'll have dual. And so essentially it was a way to say, for the people who wanted to represent on geography, we're not going to allow population to steamroll you. For those who wanted it based on population, we're going to give you the ability to set, you know, and the House is empowered with all these things. Like, that's where budget bills have to originate. That's where tax bills have to originate. So, you know, those would be more populist kind of things.
And they were also modeling Parliament, you know, British Parliament to some extent as well. And we don't have lords in the United States. So they instead invented the Senate,
right,
which is, wasn't, you know, we don't have families that are landed and have lordships. But at the time, and we've talked about this before, state legislatures would pick the senators. And so it was a way of ensuring that somebody that was well-known and well-liked by the people back home always got to sit in representation of the state in what was essentially perform the function of the House of Lords, which was the Senate. The thing about our revolution was that we were a revolution, but a very business-like one. Very much, this was just a disagreement among gentlemen that involved some muskets and some charged words, perhaps. but it was a little different than what we saw later with the French Revolution, which was much more of a populist revolt,
right.
and arguably a lot bloodier.
It is interesting when you frame it like that, because I think the American Revolution, one of the things that did happen, and you saw this with the signing of the Declaration of Independence, where you had ultimately after months and months and months of negotiation, you had 13 colonies and a bunch of disparate people unanimously sign on to this. And what you had was basically a process whereby disagreements were worked out and there was a common unity among different, we call them maybe factions today or different interests, that said our collective interest is in leaving the monarchy, leaving England and becoming our own country. In the French Revolution, you have something, I think, more akin to what we're experiencing today, which is different. Everybody agreed that they didn't want the king anymore, so let's get rid of the king. But then they all hated each other. And so what you see in the French Revolution is wave after wave after wave after wave of these different little partisan factions saying, I know we agreed on that, but we disagree on like this one finer point. So like all of you are going to get the guillotine now. And then you have it swing the other way where it's like, okay, now we're in power and we didn't like what you did to us. And so all of you are being exiled. And it was this kind of crazy back and forth. We avoided that, at least until we got to the Civil War.
Right. And you could argue that we put off that, so I teach conflict management in class. And not that an individual interpersonal conflict can always be compared to a national debate. But there's different conflict styles. And I always say, well, hey, it's different styles are better for different situations. And I always put it up on a grid and I say it has to do with your investment in the issue. You know, if you're highly invested in the issue and you're not highly invested in your relationship with the other people, you're going to be very competitive. You're going to use the win-lose strategy. I win, you lose. If you lose, I'm happy. And so I said a lot of politics ends up being very competitive because we don't really care about people who aren't us when we vote. But compromise is right there in the middle. And compromise by nature is win and lose. I win and lose, and you win and lose. In other words, for it to be a compromise, we both have to receive something. And we also have to feel pain. And that's what we saw, and I think coming out of the Constitutional Convention is, both sides got something they wanted. The South got to keep their slaves, and they got to keep their economic system and their landed system that they had and that the people in charge there liked. The North got their country, and they got capital was closer to them and some other things. That was the wins. The losses, though, was, though, that the South got to always be afraid of the North and the North's political power maybe creeping up and taking their power away from them. And the North had to deal with the fact that they gave up slavery, that people were held in bondage. And for a lot of people, particularly in New England, that was not just a political issue, that was a moral issue. And it was really hard to take. And indeed, in England, it was out of vogue. It was illegal, becoming illegal in England, and in the British Empire to follow would banish or ban slavery. And so a lot of people felt that this was a terrible compromise, but it was something that needed to happen. We both got something. We both felt some pain. And I always say, though, in the conflict classes that compromise is great. You might imagine using compromise in your marriage or compromise in your relationships quite a bit, and maybe we do. But if you do it all the time, if all you do is compromise, eventually the two parties will begin to feel some resentment, and maybe it's less likely that they'll become collaborative and more likely that they'll become competitive. And I think that we saw that boil over. We had the Compromise of the Constitution and the Missouri Compromise later in the 1800s. And then that boiled over in a huge civil war.
Right. I think a couple of those early compromises are instructive because they kind of followed with the ratification of the Constitution. Essentially, the Bill of Rights was a compromise. The Articles of Confederacy, which didn't work, that was like the pre-Constitution way we govern the continent, basically said states will all govern themselves and then come together when they have mutual interests where they want to work together. And it was unworkable, particularly from like a business standpoint. And so there were a lot of people who wanted a stronger centralized government that could sign treaties, dictate trade, work with interstate commerce.
Regulate currency and things like that.
Yeah. But there was a huge fear that if we unleash like a centralized government on the population, we're going to go right back to what we fought against in the Revolutionary War. And so the compromise was this thing called the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, the 10th of which says, basically, if we don't spell it out here in the Constitution, the federal government can't do it. Like, you know, so don't worry, we're not changing, you know, you're still going to get to do everything except for these like few things we've spelled out. Of course, that's not how history is unfolded, but that was the compromise, you know, to get it moving forward. You mentioned where the Capitol was located. That was actually also a post-Constitution decision. The new government in the United States was having huge fiscal problems. All these states were having huge fiscal problems. And one of the ways that we looked at resolving it was to create a federal bank and assume all the states' debts, basically free all the states from having these kind of burdensome debts so that they could essentially start over. And that was really, really difficult because the southern states didn't have as much debt. The northern states did. The northern states were, on one hand, more profligate. On the other's hand, also paid for more of the Civil War or the Revolutionary War than the South did. The South, in turn, got the capital moved from what at the time was in New York, further south to Washington, D.C. And that was a huge relocation of power in a way that, I mean, you can see the first four of the first five presidents were from Virginia.
Virginia, yeah. Essentially, it was in Virginia. They took the land and made its own district.
Yes. So you had these kind of early compromises that today are kind of, oh, yeah, that's what they decided to do. I think what we don't respect in a historical context is how difficult these things were. I mean, these were not... I think we're going to get into some of the modern things in a bit. But you look at like an issue like immigration, where we have two very strong camps today, but you know, for all outside views, like a clear path towards reaching a compromise, yet they can't even talk about the issue. Back then, these were unresolvable issues that they managed to work through and come to a compromise resolution. I think we don't appreciate how heroic it was to actually reach those compromises.
The other thing I think we miss in looking back at history is we don't realize the sentiment and pressures that existed at that time and how different they would have been from our time.
Right.
And we view things through that modern lens. This might be too simplistic, perhaps, but I feel like the United States at the founding of its Constitution was like a teenager and that it was saying to itself, you know what, no matter what, I'm not going to be like my dad or my mom.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to be...
That's the one thing we can agree on.
Yeah. Right. We're not going to be like we're not going to have the monarchy. We're going to have these other systems. And that the rest of our history is this aging process in which the United States, no longer a teenager, is realizing these adult problems.
Becomes more and more like the old man.
And becomes a little bit more, maybe not entirely, but a little bit more like... It's parent. And I think that's maybe something we can compare to our own lives. I know.
It's Dig Deep on KAXE, KBXE. Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone will continue on this conversation and how we got to where we are now in terms of compromise.